Accession number 20670, Reel 2.
Joseph Abbott, Reel 3. So from Maidstone you went to...
Ashford, yes.
And what was that camp like?
Well, that was, again, it was more of an estate, and we were sort of in huts, tutments on the estate. That was around about the period when the first buzz bombs came over, you know. Took everybody a bit by surprise because we thought it was a plane on fire, and of course those were the gases being expelled at the rear of the thing. But I think that leaving, getting down there and being involved, we had to start waterproofing vehicles and things of that nature then. And it was obviously, it must have been getting near the time, not that we knew particularly at the moment, you know, at that particular moment when we got down there, but we got into Ashford on occasions. That was when we saw one of the RAF lads' wagons going past the bottom of the field where we were in these huts. And if we could get a lift, we got a lift into Ashford, and it was an opportunity because when you got into Ashford there was one or two church units and things down there which used to say, well, if you got into the audience at one of these, and they said, forward those who can see the light. And of course all the blokes that were in the army got over what, because they knew they were going to get tea and cake at the other. So they used to see a stream of lads going up for tea and cake at the end when they saw the light. Terrible thing to do, I know. It's not that we were irreligious, it was just that we liked a bit of cake going again, you know. But
what was the town of Ashford like? I mean, overrun with military, I suppose.
Well, yes, there were quite a number of militia knocking up. We didn't get in very often into Ashford because, again, we were busy involved with things on the estate and the training and the waterproofing and one thing or another. One thing that does stand out in my mind, when I had to do a corporal of the guard one particular time when I was on the guard in with a little hut and a slit trench, and in the middle of the night we heard a sudden wailing, and this was a real wail, you know, and of course I thought, what the devil is that? It sounded like somebody in pain, you know. So we decided to go and have a look, and I went along with Lance Corporal Ebley, who I mentioned was killed there, and in the middle of one of the fields was a big house, and as we approached, this wailing got louder and louder. So when we got to the house, it was a big house, I remember hearing this wailing, so I thought, well, we'd better find out what it is, and knocked at the door, and I remember a maid opening the door, all dressed in black, and I said, excuse me, but there's an awful noise going on around, I don't know if you know. She said, oh yes, she said, it's the lady of the house, her husband died. So she said, you better come in, and we went in, and her husband was laid out on the table there. So I said, well, you know, we'd better go and leave, you know, the bereavement, but she'd be better. She said, we can't get her in, she's locked herself out on the balcony. So I said, well, you better keep an eye on her, you know, if she's in that state. And so we went back to the guard post, and little Tommy Palmer, driver in Normandy, a lad from Norfolk, he was standing by the edge of this little slit trench that we're supposed to use in event of anything wrong, and suddenly stepped back, and the next thing was Tommy was in the trench with his legs and his head sort of like this, so we had to haul him out of the trench. I remember that. That sticks out.
So you were a corporal by then?
Oh, yeah.
So when did that happen?
Well, I was a lance corporal. When I made a lance corporal at Maidstone, and then when I got about 2 weeks later, I was a full corporal. Another thing that's again, which I stand out in my mind, that is that when I was mentioned earlier, is that you got the odd sort of bad egg, like, for want of a better word, and I remember that you always had certain individuals who were a bit loud, you know, like to throw the weight about, and we had a chap who'd been a sergeant actually, and he was one of the loud voice sergeant types, you know, that used to do a lot of shouting and bawling, and he used to come back. He was demoted because of some, he was down to a corporal for something he'd done, pinching a jeep or something, but he used to come in rather the worse for drink on some occasions, and setting off a smoke bomb in the hut, you know, which was stupid, basically. But that attitude, strange enough, when we got to Normandy, two chaps, both NCOs, sergeants at the time, which were of a similar nature, wounded themselves in the foot so that they wouldn't have to go any further, you know. And that was, they were stuck in my mind. They were the ones that did a lot of shouting. And
those were the sergeants?
There were two sergeants at the time, I remember.
Can you remember their names?
Well, no, I mean, I'll keep those to myself. But the other one I remember from our hut got wounded, just a flesh wound in the ankle later on in France, and the noise he made coming back and get out of the way, and you know, and unfortunately that had been done by one of our own sort of troops in the same squadron. They'd mistaken us for Germans and opened fire, and of course they'd wounded them, but however, these things happen.
Yeah. So but, do you know how you were selected to be a lance corporal and then a corporal? Did you know it was coming, or did it?
I don't know. You see, this is the point. I'm a bashful sort of bloke, and I never like to say, "Well, I was good at this and I was good at that." But
so
I
what
suppose
were you good at? You can tell me.
No, I just got on with what I was supposed to do and did it as well as I could. And I thought, well, that's all I can do. You know, as far as I can go. There's no point in being stupid and not doing it, because there's no sense in it to me. And it's been the same all my life, and I think I suffered for it eventually. I had a stroke eventually. But Ashford, as I say, Ashford again, it was quite pleasant there, but we knew then, when we started doing things like waterproofing and that, we knew then something was coming off, you know. And then all of a sudden we got an indication that D-Day had started, and our B squadron from the regiment had gone over with them. So we knew that we knew they were there then. And
what did you hear about D-Day?
Well, everybody then was anxious to know what had happened to B and what they were going through, and this was the concern, basically, I suppose, of everybody. What are they going through now?
Did you get much news of what was happening?
Not a lot then. We got, I suppose, what they thought fit to tell us then. They couldn't obviously disclose too much, and the reconnaissance initially was superfluous to some extent in the beaches. It was their job was after the beaches, you see. So they did a lot of carrying ammunition and stuff just initially in B squadron, I believe, and then ultimately, of course, they found out a bit. But we then were waiting to know when we were going to go, you know.
Thinking it's going to be any day.
Well, we thought that it could be any time, you know. And then as it happened, we didn't actually get into Normandy until July.
Because so you stayed at Ashford, didn't you?
We stayed at Ashford until we were sent up to embark on the Liberty ship at John E. Ward, it was called, the Liberty ship. And we had to embark on that? Sorry?
Sorry, where did you go to?
London. Mm.
Yeah. Which bit of London?
Sorry?
Which bit? Whereabouts? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh.
How did you go there?
Yeah, the docks. I don't know what to call the docks up there. I forget now. I mean, I'm not conversing too much in London.
How did you get there? Did they?
Oh, by our own vehicles. We got up. I mean, we were a carrier troop then. I mean, and the armoured car troop. So we all went up already charged up, you know.
What did you see at the docks?
Not an awful lot, because you were busy getting on board the Liberty ship, you know, and getting your vehicles on and all the rest of it. So there weren't an awful lot of, apart from the stevedores, there were a few of them around, but not an awful lot there. You weren't supposed to use any telephones or anything like that at all. Up there, so you couldn't phone home or anything of that nature. At least I wasn't able to phone home. I know one lad that did. But
so what was it like getting all of you lot onto the ship then?
Well, you got onto the ship and it was, to say the least, it seemed a bit cramped because you were in hammocks down below and you were perhaps two or three hammocks, one under the, you know. So it wasn't very particularly pleasant, that wasn't. And also water was short, and the crews, American crews, would sell you some water occasionally. But we got on to those, and of course we were, the weather broke, and we were stuck on those for over a week.
Right. Do you know the date you went on?
Well, yeah, it's all in there, if you don't mind me referring to it. I can't
okay.
just...
Yeah, that's all right. Unless you... So the date you actually got on the ship?
The date we got on the ship would be the 17th of July.
And
the date we got off was the 24th of July.
Right. So where did you go out of dock straight away?
Oh, we sailed out of the docks, yes, straight away. But we were anchored probably off the French coast for quite some time. Well, I'm saying nearly a week. And all you saw when you got a chance, you see, we were short of food by that time. We were living on... they had some tinned sort of mayonnaise stuff that they managed to get from somewhere, and that, with rough weather, didn't do an awful lot of good for people, you know. But added to that, of course, there were bodies floating past the side, even at that time, floating past the ship, and obviously, you know, you just had to let them float because there was nothing you could do at that time.
What was the mood like on the ship?
Well, again, it was fortunately for the recce. I don't know if it applied to others as well, but you got some bright sparks in among them, and there was always somebody that would raise a laugh and brighten you up somehow. You know, this happened, as I say, this esprit de corps somehow was grand, it really was, because you always got somebody that would lift you. You got depressed naturally in certain situations, and but you couldn't afford to be depressed for too long, you know, because it could cost you. But
it's a long time to wait, a week.
Well, yes, and of course you hadn't got anything that you. I mean, you couldn't, as you saw them going to the Falkland Islands, running about the decks and exercising that. There wasn't all the room there. There was cluttered up with vehicles and goodness knows what, and carriers and.
Did you have a routine? Did they impose a routine on
you? Not on the ship. Well, not that I can remember, to be quite honest. It was a case of trying to get cleaned up and shaved with a cup of water between about three, you know, and things like that. This is what went on. But people don't realise that that this is what you had to do, and you had to get on with doing something. It's because you were supposed to be clean and tidy, even so, you know.
Could you see the French coast?
Oh, yeah.
What could you hear?
Oh, there was always the noise, the shelling, and the shelling from the Navy and things like that. There was a bombardment all the time, and fortunately for us, the aircraft was a bit more superior than the Germans at that time, and of course, although they were still about, you know. But it was it wasn't pleasant, let's put it that way, and it was a bit depressing to see these things, you know, floating by you and wondering whether you were perhaps going to join them, you know. However,
tough job for the officers too.
Pardon? Oh
tough
yeah,
job for the
yes.
On there,
yes, this is the
out.
Thing that yeah, they had it pretty rough because there was not just themselves, of course. There, they had the rest of the troop to think about, you know. But Timber was a caring sort of bloke. It was unfortunately, as I say, he got killed, but he was the sort that when you were on a route march in England or anything like that, he used to suddenly produce crystals that bathe your feet with, you know. So that he was always very considerate about things like that. He was a nice chap. Lived on a farm in Upton Nervet, I think it was, with his folks. But he was a nice chap.
So eventually, you heard that you were going to
land. We saw an odd small craft coming floating about us, and then we got the news that we were going to get off the ship. And we were, as I say, a carrier troop, and the carriers were lifted off onto what they call a rhino raft, which is a sort of just like a large raft with a motor attached to propel it. And we wondered just how much water was at the other end when we were going to get off, you know. But we'd had to do all this waterproofing in England, which meant that you had sheets of metal up in front of you on the carrier, and all the working parts and things had to be done up and cleaned off when you got on shore, one thing or another. But fortunately for us, we got off the Rhino raft virtually into dry, well, not dry sand, but sand, and we didn't get into much water in our case. But once we got off that thing, we never stopped.
Where did you land?
Well, La Hamelle, I think La Hamelle, what was then called Jig Beach, I think it was called, they call it. I've got a thing in there, as I say again, with all that.
So what was it like coming off? I mean, you suddenly know you're going in.
When you came off, you got just this sort of desolation in front of you, that's all you could say it was. And a lot of people waving you on and shouting you on, and you couldn't stop and say, well, you know, how's Mrs. So-and-so? You had to go, and you had to move and move and move, and you just couldn't stop. And we had to find a squadron harbour to get ourselves organised, obviously. And I know we went off, careering off up the road, following Sergeant Cox, as it was at the time, and he beetled off up this road until we came to a road with two blokes in a ditch. So I saw Coxie stop, and I pulled up behind there, and I heard him say, can you tell me where 53rd wreck is? Well, I don't know, mate, but if you go up there about 300 or 400 yards, you'll be with Jerry. So with that, we turned about and came back. Well, we couldn't, we didn't want to go any further at that stage. So we came back and fortunately found the harbour.
When
squadron
you say
was
we,
in.
This was a whole lot of you, was it?
Well, yeah, the troop, you know. And
who was leading you then? Who was in charge?
Well, Sergeant Cox was in front of us. And he was the carrier in front, and of course we whizzed about and about turning our back. And I remember we passed through Oh God. The tapestry place.
Bayeux.
We passed through Bayeux. And I remember a little French lad coming up when we stopped in this town square there. And he was cigarettes pour papa, you know. And of course, my French at the time was only just beginning. And however, I managed to explain to him that I'm afraid I didn't smoke and I hadn't got any cigarettes at the time, so I'm very sorry. I gave him the chocolate, and that was it. That was our introduction to the French, as far as we were concerned.
What state were the villages and towns in Bayeux in that you saw? What state were the towns and villages in that you saw on your first day?
Oh, well, Bayeux seemed, on the surface, reasonable. I couldn't say other than that because, I mean, you haven't time to look around or anything. But obviously, it's, you know, but I've got some photos in that of the passing through taken by the diff photographer, and those would explain specifically what they were like. Some of them were absolutely desolate, you know. Desolate.
Were you surprised at the amount of devastation?
Well, to say surprised, you can't say you express surprise. It was just shock, basically, that you know, the way things were just being laid waste, and you wondered sometimes just what purpose is it doing it at all, you know. This is what I think. You began to sort of, well, say you began, you just wondered, just what do you get out of it? Who's going to get anything out of this at all? Because all this has got to be rebuilt and all that. I mean, it's all expense and everything. It's, but some of the villages and things initially in Normandy were pretty well flattened, you know.
Did you see any of the civilian population, the French population?
Oh, yeah, initially you saw one or two. Not a lot, as I say, because you were, again, you seemed to be concerned mainly with getting to know what you were going to do and what you were expected to and where the rest of the squadron was, you know. So you saw people, but they themselves must have been under a tremendous amount of shock because, you know, a lot of them were... They didn't sort of say, hello there, you know, and some did, naturally, but a lot were just walking about as if wondering what the heck had, you know, they were going to do. You could tell that by seeing them.
Did you tell me the date you landed? I'm sorry.
The date I landed was the 24th, wasn't it? Yes. 24th we landed.
24th of July.
24th of July, yes.
And what
4th.
Time of day was that? Do you remember?
It would be as far, yes, I think it would be early morning, well, not early morning, but mid-morning or something like that, as far as I can remember.
So on that first day, where did you go to then? Where did you stop?
Well, looking from this, it just, it doesn't say where we went, but as I say, we were busy looking for the rest of the squadron, and we finished up, and that was, I think, around Le Hamel or somewhere around about there.
So you found them?
Aramans, somewhere around about that area. Around that area, I know.
Right. So you found the rest of them?
Oh, we found them, eventually.
And where were they and what were they doing?
Well, just getting organised. It seemed chaotic. I mean, everything... I mean, right from the beach, it was... To me, it just seemed like chaos. It was organised chaos, we know, but it just seemed, you know, everybody was careering about.
And so when you got to the squadron, I mean, what was it like there? I mean,
well, when you got to the squadron, then you were told then eventually that you would be going into unable to carry on with the recce role as it was then, but you'd have to do some sort of supporting role, you know. And that happened, and we got into a place called Marseillais, and we relieved the Oxen Books.
Right. Don't refer to the book for a moment. That's fine. When you got to the squadron, then I mean, what did you do? Dig in or?
You know? Oh, yes, you got instructions to dig in. You got a little scoop out, you know, and underneath the carrier or whatever, or near the carriers. You see, you'd come from England. you'd been doing schemes in England. You'd been using bits of gunpowder and flares and stuff like that, and, you know, blanks and goodness knows what. But then you'd come into reality, you know, and it wasn't just sort of stuff like that that was coming over. It was stuff that was going to do some damage if it got near enough, you know. So it was completely different, in a sense, going from one extreme to the other, you know. You were at one place, you were, in a sense, enjoying life, and the next place, you didn't know how long you were going to end your life, you know. This is a funny part, really.
So were you all quite sort of, I wouldn't say frightened, but, you know, you were quite sort of nervous?
Well, I think everybody, to some extent, must have been a bit scared, naturally. But, again, the sort of, once you get in and you get sort of accustomed a bit, then the humour comes out, and this is what, as I say, what happened in the unit. It was just all the time, it was something that came along to lift you a bit, you know.
So, that first night in France?
Well, that first night, that you were lying virtually in this little hole in the ground, and you were listening to all this stuff going overhead, and you could see the glow, the red glow and that in the sky, and you were trying to get some sleep, you know, fitful sleep, I suppose. But at the same time, you were always on the qui vive in case something happened that you know, you didn't know was going to happen. But I remember lying in there, strangely enough, I remember lying in that, whether I got dozed off or whatever it was, but I remember, it's a funny thing to say, I know, but Lord, I remember seeing, whatever it was, a dream or whatever it was, this gantry going up. It was like a steel gantry, you know, like over a railway crossing. And Cox, Sergeant Cox, going up this gantry, and he's turning around to me and he shouts, "Come on, bud." So I said, "No, I don't think I've got time, actually." And that was it. It went then, you know. Some days later, two or three days later, when my carrier got hit and that, I was telling you, I ran behind, you know, from the carrier. And behind the little cottage at the end, there were some gates I had to run through, wine gates. And I got there and dropped down behind the gates, and Sergeant Cox was sitting on his carrier behind this cottage. And he shouts, "Come on here, bud." And I got to him and I jumped up on the carrier and sat on the carrier, and I had to jump straight off. And as I jumped straight off, Jerry put an 88 through the cottage and it killed Cox. And that's always stuck, because I remember seeing him going up that gantry, and it seems strange, you know. It's, I don't know what you call that, extrasensory perception or whatever it is, I don't know, but I remember that quite plainly.
So where was he when he was killed? He was in the cottage, was he, or he was on the carrier?
Oh, he was on the carrier, as it happened, and he was behind this cottage, and we'd been hit, you see, we'd been hit by the Germans, and
so he called you across to his
he
carrier.
He called me,
and you
to get
got there.
I was just no. I got to the carrier and got on the carrier. And as soon as I got on the back of the carrier, I had to jump straight off, because had I stayed there, I was sat there, and Coxie was there. Had I stayed there, strangely enough, it was just a feeling.
What alerted you to jump off?
I don't know. It was just a feeling. I had to get straight off. Immediately, I got on. I had to get off.